News from China fills almost every section of the newspaper, but even well-informed Americans may have a hard time naming its top officials. Joining me now to explain whether that situation is by design is Susan L. Shirk, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in charge of U.S.-Chinese relations. She's now the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She's also the author of China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Susan Shirk to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Hu Jintao is China's president. What kind of leader is he?
He's a colorless organization man who hasn't really done anything very outstanding in his first 5 years of leadership, but is going to be given a second five-year term at the upcoming party congress, nevertheless.
Because he's secure in the job?
He is secure in the job in the sense that they have seemed to evolve a norm of giving every leader now two five-year terms, and since China really has collective leadership by a small group of oligarchs, they may like having a leader who doesn't aggrandize too much power to himself but shares it with the other leaders.
So that means that Hu Jintao isn't as powerful as his predecessors Jiang Zemin and Deng Xiaoping.
Well, yes, I think it's fair to say that he's even less powerful than Jiang Zemin, but both Jiang and Hu are much, much less powerful than Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, who were, of course, great charismatic leaders who were members of the founding generation of the People's Republic of China and had great personal followings. Today's leaders in China really don't have much of a personal following.
Should I assume that despite his lack of charisma, that Hu Jintao is effective as a politician, knows how to play the game?
Well, we'll see in a month when the party congress is held just how effective he is. There's no sign, I think it's fair to say he knows how to play the game in that nobody believes that the other oligarchs have ganged up against him or have a plan to get rid of him. So he survived, but it's his record really isn't terribly impressive so far.
But it's obviously his colorlessness that to some degree has made him so attractive.
Yeah, it's part of his appeal to the other members of the elite.
Could he keep the presidency but end up with a Politburo or that is not filled with his allies?
Well, first of all, the number one position in China is actually not the presidency. The number one position is the General Secretary of the Communist Party.
But he's also that, and he's also
the
chairman of the Central Military Commission.
That's right. And so, again, this is a formula designed to try to avoid any splits in the collective leadership. They do give one person all of those three key positions, but they don't really give him as much authority, certainly as Mao or Deng had, to get all his own people in place. And they want to make sure that the patronage and perhaps the corruption are shared among a group of leaders.
But I'm sure also there is a fear of a return to the sort of thing that we saw with Mao and to a lesser degree with Deng Xiaoping, the
exactly.
cult of personality that allowed for excesses.
Exactly, exactly. So that's the dilemma here that these guys face. On the one hand, they want to prevent one person from aggrandizing all the power and maybe going off half-cocked the way Mao did. In Deng Xiaoping's case, I think they feel that his personal authority, which enabled him to introduce China's market reforms and opening in the late 70s, ended up being a good thing. But if you've got one-man rule and that person has his own ideas about what to do, it could put the whole Communist Party rule in China, the whole national stability at risk. So they don't want that. So they do prefer a power-sharing collective leadership arrangement. But the risks of that are that the competition among them could spill out and become public in a way that encourages people to start demanding political change, encourages people to demonstrate, and the whole house of cards could collapse. So it's a very delicate balance that they try to strike of collective leadership, but keeping it the competition that, of course, does exist, secret from the rest of the people.
My guest on Backstory today is Susan L. Shirk, who is director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, also author of China, Fragile Superpower. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It sounds to me like Hu Jintao isn't all that secure, but here he has these three titles: President of China, General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and Chairman of the Central Military Commission. And as I understand it, the military is the key to staying in power in China. So does that mean that he has the support of the military?
Well, there's no indication that he doesn't. And the military is, as you say, crucial in backing up the party leader. If, for example, there were to be a split in the leadership and massive demonstrations, as you had in China in 1989 during the Tiananmen crisis, the only reason that the party survived was that the military remained loyal, came in and forcibly put down the demonstrations. But on the other hand, the military doesn't play the same kingmaker role that it once did. It's not as crucial in choosing a successor, for example, which is the important event that will occur at the upcoming Party Congress.
If Americans recognize any name in the leadership, it would be Hu Jintao. Few people probably know the name of China's current premier, Wen Jiabao.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because he doesn't have much power?
No. In fact, he and Hu Jintao operate as a kind of duumvirate, as a team, and they're often referred to in that way.
Does that mean they agree with each other on most things?
I think on most things they do. They have evolved a kind of platform that they call building a harmonious society, and you'll probably at the upcoming Party Congress see something about that put in China's constitution, which they tend to revise every 5 years. I doubt that they agree on everything, but they have a pretty effective division of labor. Wen Jiabao leads the economic policy side, and Hu Jintao is in charge of politics. But this notion of harmonious society is what you might call a kind of compassionate communism, trying to demonstrate that this generation of party leaders cares about the have-nots, the people who haven't done as well under the market reform and opening, the people living in the inland provinces, the rural population, the people in China's Rust Belt in the Northeast. So I'd say that they've evolved that platform together, and it's one that they'll want to sustain into the next five-year term.
Is there any chance that Wen Jiabao would succeed Hu?
No, because this is all now done pretty much according to age. And they do have a retirement age, which each time they have a transition seems to be more strictly enforced. So since Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao are about the same age, he will not succeed Hu Jintao. They need to look to the fifth generation of leaders, people in their 50s, to find a successor.
So there are a lot of things we understand about how the Chinese government works, although you write in your book that understanding how Chinese politics work involves a lot of guesswork.
That's right.
Is there an is there a modern equivalent, a Chinese equivalent to the old Kremlinologists?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, we're all engaged in that. I mean, I personally try to understand how Chinese politics works, you know, based on the fact that I've been going there since 1971. I met Zhou Enlai back in the old days. I'm a real old China hand, but I'm also a political scientist, and I want to compare China to other authoritarian regimes and understand the system. But in addition to that, we're all looking at the possible successors, for example, and trying to figure out if they will be able to identify one person to be the successor, or will have to compromise by having two, three, or four get promoted who will be competing over the next 5 years. If they are able to identify one person, then that will mean much less political risk, not just over the next 5 years, but conceivably that person could be the leader of China up to 2022. So they will have gone a long way to maintain Communist Party rule if they're able to do that. On the other hand, if they can't agree and they're going to have to promote a small group of people who will be fighting it out, competing over the next 5 years, then that raises the risks of open splits in the leadership, which could be very, very dangerous.
I remember when the Kremlinologists used to assess a person's position in the hierarchy by where he was standing during the May Day parade.
Right, right. And we don't have as many of those ceremonial occasions anymore, but they still watch to see how much press coverage people get, who travels with Hu Jintao when he goes out to the provinces to review the situation. You know, so there's still lots of rumors and lots of watching the tea leaves.
There's a Politburo Standing Committee and a Central Committee. What are their roles, and do they overlap?
Well, when we talk about the oligarchs, the party leadership, we're talking primarily about the Politburo Standing Committee, which right now has 9 members.
Is it like our cabinet?
No, it's not. Our cabinet is the State Council on the government side.
What about a government in parliamentary governments?
No, it's not. It's not the government at all. It's the party.
Uh-huh.
And so that they don't necessarily micromanage very specific policy decisions. And they do give China's cabinet, which is the State Council, where all the ministers and the heads of the Economic Commission sit. That cabinet has quite a lot of authority over economic policy, but control of the media, ideology, some of the big foreign policy issues, including relations with the United States or relations with Japan or the Taiwan issue, will be decided by the Politburo Standing Committee.
How are its members decided upon?
They are chosen by the Central Committee. Now, the Central Committee, and there's a body in between called the Politburo. So, unfortunately, we're on radio, so I can't draw you an organization chart here.
But it's complicated.
It is complicated. I've got it in my book. But the Central Committee consists of 200 to 300 officials, many of whom are government or military officials as well as party officials. For example, every one of China's provincial governors and provincial party secretaries, basically, of 33 state governments in our system, they sit on the Central Committee. Also, all the ministers sit on the Central Committee, and then the top military officials. So this party Congress will choose a new Central Committee. The Central Committee will, in turn, choose the Politburo and the Politburo Standing Committee. So it is complicated. We do know something about it. It's not, but what we don't know is really is what the outcome will be at the Party Congress.
Well, since they choose the president, how did Hu Jintao gain support when he was chosen in 2002?
Well, that's an important question because he was anointed by Deng Xiaoping 10 years before.
Of course, that doesn't mean anything.
Just ratified by these bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen other people who have been anointed who haven't really remained in power.
Ah, yes, right. And I do believe, I'm one of the China watchers who believes that these formal institutional arrangements within the Communist Party, including the authority of the Central Committee, may actually be exercised one day. And even if you don't see it being exercised, I believe that when the oligarchs choose the next successor, they have to choose someone who is basically acceptable to the Central Committee. But also one day, and this happened in the Soviet Union, by the way, and it's happened in communist politics in Vietnam, the Central Committee may just say no to someone who's been nominated by the oligarchs. There's a lot of unpredictability in the future of Chinese politics.
My guest on Backstory is Susan L. Shirk, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in charge of U.S.-Chinese relations, now the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She has a book from Oxford University Press called China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. We will continue our conversation after this. And we're back on Backstory with Susan L. Shirk, who is director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and also the author of China, Fragile Superpower, How China's Internal Politics Could Derail Its Peaceful Rise. And we'll get into the implications of that subtitle somewhere down the line. There'll be a party conference next week. Is that when the National People's Congress meets? Next month, I mean. Is that when the National People's Congress meets?
No, it doesn't. It will meet the following March. And the National People's Congress is China's parliament, China's legislature. It's indirectly elected by lower-level legislatures, but the party actually appoints the leaders of China's legislature.
Do they have any power?
Yes, they do pass a lot of laws, and a lot of those laws are quite important, but they don't have any power over leadership selection. What will happen is the leaders, the vice premiers, the new ministers, many of them will be appointed by that party congress. Some of them have already been appointed in the lead up to the party congress.
The Chinese government recently replaced several of its key ministers.
Right.
Is that an effort by Hu to consolidate his power, do you think?
For sure.
One of them, Finance Minister Zhen Renjing, was thought to be a candidate for the elite Politburo, but he resigned for personal reasons. Is that like when a politician in this country says, I want to spend more time with my family?
Yes. I think it's fair to say it's about the same kind of euphemism, and everyone knows, or at least there's a lot of gossip about a scandal, a personal scandal in his private life. But in China, the newspapers are not reporting what happened, whereas, of course, in the United States, we have the newspapers reporting the true story, because we have investigative journalists who go and find out, and then they're allowed to report on it.
Now, we've been hearing about the anti-corruption campaign in China, but it seems to be fairly selective. Some people who are accused of being corrupt lose their jobs. In other cases, they seem to be immune. So is this just a way, really, of of weeding out the supporters and getting rid of the people who might be problematic?
A lot of people in China have that cynical view of what it's all about. And indeed, in the bad old days under Mao, you would accuse someone of being a capitalist rotor or a reactionary, and you would use ideological attacks to go after them. But now the weapon of choice is anti-corruption. And certainly there's selective prosecutions, if you will, of high-level corrupt officials. It has to be decided actually within the Politburo whether or not to carry out an investigation of these people.
Are China's leaders trying to chart a middle course between being responsive and being repressive?
That's an interesting way to put it. And I think it's a good way to put it, because they are responsive because they feel so politically insecure. And they need to get leadership politics under control to prevent public splits, but they also need to be responsive to all the demonstrations that are occurring every day throughout China, in the countryside as well as the cities, over issues like terrible environmental pollution and the poisoning of the rivers, about land requisitions by corrupt local officials, laying off workers at state-owned enterprises without paying them adequately. There are a tremendous number of discontents that are being expressed through protest, and that actually explains this compassionate communism platform. Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao are trying to be responsive to popular dissatisfaction and discontents. But on the other hand, they don't want to go too far. They don't want to introduce any fundamental accountability to people. So that's the dilemma. How do you maintain authoritarian communist politics, but in a way that is stable and maintains the support of people?
Do the leaders still fear that another Tiananmen-like event would bring down the party?
Oh, totally. I think that is that's very much in their minds, because it was really a close call. And let's remember that it happened in 1989, just at the time that the Berlin Wall fell, and communist regimes in Soviet Union and Eastern Europe began to collapse. So I think you can tell from their behavior that ever since 1989, they have been really worried that their own days in power are numbered. I mean, they just look out the window and they see a society that is so different than the society of the Mao and Deng Xiaoping eras. You know, there's a people, most people don't work for state-owned enterprises, they work for private enterprises. 160 million people get their information over the internet. Almost 200 million people have moved from the countryside to the cities. China's on the move. And yet you've got this old-fashioned authoritarian regime trying to stay afloat on top of this society that's been turned upside down. So, yes, they are quite worried.
Well, Deng Xiaoping opened a Pandora's box, but they seem to pick and choose what they're going to deal with. Those protests you mentioned, which keep on growing, sometimes the government makes an adjustment. Other times it just cracks down. Or we see other situations. This weekend, New York Times reporter Zhao Yan was released after being held in prison on fraud charges for 3 years.
Right.
And that was after the New York Times reported in 2004 that Jiang Zemin was going to step down. He did step down. So what was the fraud?
Well, this brings us back to why we know so little about China's leaders and leadership politics. Because the Chinese Communist Party, although it has allowed a commercial media to develop and allowed the internet and internet websites to report the news, on the other hand, there is a total ban on all reporting of internal deliberations of the Communist Party and even the government. So why was Jiayuan treated so harshly?
Because he broke a story?
Yeah, exactly.
And they wanted to break it themselves.
Pardon me?
They wanted to break it themselves at the appropriate time.
They don't want people to know about the competition, the campaigns for power within the Communist Party elite. That's the most sensitive issues in Chinese politics.
My guest is Susan L. Shirk. We're talking about the Chinese leadership today on Backstory. You've been talking about the Internet. Well, President Hu Jintao said a few months back in April that he wants to rid the Internet of unhealthy content and make it a platform for the Communist Party, which suggests more censorship. Is it possible? Can he totally control the Internet?
Not totally. But I am struck by the fact that in the lead-up to the Party Congress, they actually shut down quite a few Internet, what they call them, IDCs, Internet Data Centers. These are the platforms for thousands of servers that it's basically China's blogosphere. That's where the bloggers are based. That's where the Internet chat rooms are based. And I think they'll open it up again after the Party Congress, but in this sensitive period, they're so paranoid about the risk of information about what's going on in the inner circle from getting out that they are using a very heavy hand to control information.
Well, they may be sensitive and paranoid, but China seems to be charting its own course when it comes to foreign policy and diplomacy. It seems to be perfectly willing to stand on its own on issues like North Korea and the Sudan, mm-hmm. Because they realize that the rest of the world can do little about it?
Well, actually, Chinese foreign policy does reflect domestic politics in two very different ways. On the one hand, I would argue that most of China's behavior in the world is pretty flexible and pragmatic, and China has been very concerned about its reputation as a responsible power, and you do see changes in the way it's handling issues like North Korea and Sudan, and that's because it's very important to maintain a good relationship with the United States and not to have any big international conflicts that could slow down economic growth and lead to domestic political unrest. But on the hot-button issues in Chinese domestic politics of Taiwan and Japan especially, there they feel they have to always take a very tough stand because public opinion, increasingly nationalistic, wants a strong leader.
You mentioned earlier that there is expressed concern about inequality, and so there's talk about improving health, education, and social services. Does President Hu seem inclined to initiate any of those reforms or simply to say that he'd like to see changes?
I think you may see some progress on that front in his second term. There's been a lot of work done, especially on health care and pensions, also on education. And the government does have the revenue now. They've got, they're not facing any budget deficits. They've got the money. And they really know that they need to get a lot of this social safety net, these social programs in place, because China's population is aging. And as the population becomes older, they need to get these programs in place. They've got a kind of window here over the next 10 or 20 years to do that, and they need to get going. And if they don't, they're going to increase social discontent, which is, of course, a serious threat to Communist Party rule.
We have very little time left, but China is huge, and it is my sense that an awful lot of stuff goes on without any knowledge by the people in Beijing. How much control do the the political leaders actually have?
Well, there's a lot of local decentralization. Local leaders are really kind of the local emperors. And it's one of the puzzles of Chinese politics that all of those local leaders are appointed by the party in Beijing, and yet they don't necessarily follow the orders of the folks in Beijing. They go their own way. They're not accountable to the public, so they're just focused really on developing their economies, keeping the economy growing, job creation, so there won't be protest activity. And it's a very difficult challenge for the leaders in Beijing to have their policies implemented throughout the country. You know, there's a traditional Chinese saying about the emperor being far away.
We have to leave it there. We can figure that out. Susan Shirk, author of China, Fragile Superpower, thank you so much for participating in Backstory today.
My pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, Tiki Barber looks at life before, with, and after the New York Giants. Then Galt McDermott, who wrote the music for Hair on his upcoming 40th anniversary concerts. Plus, journalist Mike O'Connor describes uncovering his own family's dark secrets. Also, Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls on our crazy English language. By the way, if you've missed something on the show and just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Paula Crossfield, Rachel Krantz, Scott Goldberg, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.